Welcome back to the second half of the Making Waves show. To hear previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. You can email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.
Reporter Aaron Glantz was on the ground in Iraq, unembedded and independent, on his own, right after the fall of Saddam, after the American invasion of that country, and was there during the occupation. But he's back in the States now, and he's written a book about his experiences and what he believes is really going on in Iraq for regular Iraqis, for regular people. That book is called How America Lost Iraq. And he was in Champaign, Urbana just a day ago on August 25th. And I was able to sit down with him for an interview where he tells us more about the book and his experiences.
I went to Iraq as a reporter for Pacifica Radio for Free Speech Radio News. And when I first got there, I was very surprised to find that most people in Iraq were very happy that Saddam Hussein was gone, and they were not necessarily angry about the invasion. But spending time there over the next year or so, I found three key things, actually four, that really alienated the vast majority of people to the occupation and caused people to pick up the gun and shoot at American soldiers. And those are the lack of basic services like electricity and clean drinking water, the attack on Muqtada Sadr, the Shiite cleric, the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, and the bombing of Fallujah. And after these four things, at about April or May 2004, the atmosphere in Iraq had completely changed. People wanted America out right away, and they were supporting people shooting at American troops. And I came back to this country at the end of May 2004, and I found that most people had no idea what it was like to be in Iraq and didn't really understand what was going on, and that's why I decided to write a book.
And what was it like being an independent reporter in Iraq, especially an American independent reporter?
I got my start in journalism at KPFA at the flagship station of Pacifica, and I got involved in journalism because I cared about whether or not I could afford an apartment in San Francisco, the city that I grew up in, whether public transportation would be functional, whether the parks would be clean and places where people could take their children. And I saw no reason why I couldn't do the same kind of reporting in Iraq. I mean, these are the important issues no matter where you go, and I really resented the politicization of the story. Everyone wanted to know, well, what about this faction, what they want, and this faction, you know, blah, blah. And I said, well, wait a second here, let's get back to the basics. So I got in a taxi cab in Amman, Jordan, 2 weeks after the fall of Saddam Hussein with a French colleague, and we just headed in, we rented an apartment, and we stayed there, and going around, you know, in regular running taxi cabs and cars, giving people the respect that they deserve as people, you'd be surprised at how much respect that you get back and interest, and people have stories to tell. You know, you go around without an armed entourage, the way most of these corporate journalists do, and people stop to see you as somebody who's interested in listening to their story. People approach you a lot differently if you just show up. You say, I'm interested in listening to what you have to say.
Well, something I learned from Naomi Klein's talk at this spring's Media Consolidation Conference here at the University of Illinois is that American reporters in Iraq are actually using Iraqi runners and reporters to do their basic reporting for them.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a lot of talk right now about Cindy Sheehan, and she has this Camp Casey for her son, Casey Sheehan, who was killed on April 4th, 2004 in Sadr City in a terribly stupid military maneuver by the Bush administration. They took this guy, this Shiite cleric with a tremendous following, and they closed his newspaper. They arrested his chief advisor, and they said they were going to arrest him just because he had published an article in his newspaper titled "Bremer Follows in the Footsteps of Saddam." This was unacceptable, and so the U.S. Army, including Casey Sheehan, was sent in. And as an unembedded journalist, I was mostly interested in what effect this would have on the Iraqi people. So I got in a car with a translator friend, an engineer, and we weaved our way around the American tanks, and we made our way to the hospital. In the hospital, there was only one other journalist in the hospital interviewing people, and he was a CNN cameraman, but he was an Iraqi cameraman. He was not involved at all in the news decision-making process, so God knows what CNN did with his footage, because we interviewed a 15-year-old boy who had been shot in the vestibule of his apartment building by an American soldier as part of this attack, and he said, "I don't know what I could say to the Americans, it's just up to God what happens with them." I have no idea if this is something that was used by CNN. And this is the interesting thing, right? Because you have Iraqis going out there getting footage about what's interesting to them, but then they have to go back and they have to deal with the whole CNN system.
Are average Iraqis getting American news coverage? I mean, are they seeing what we see?
Well, there's satellite television in Iraq, and most people have it because this is how you get Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya, which are the main channels that people are watching. There's also Al Hurra, which means the Freedom, which is the U.S. government-funded satellite television station broadcasting out of Virginia. It's less popular. But people get CNN, they get BBC, but I don't think people are really watching it. People are watching Jazeera if they are of a more nationalist bent, and if they're kind of more more secular, or less nationalistic, more pro-American, they may be watching Arabiya, which is a little bit more like CNN than Jazeera. They're seeing totally different pictures than you are here. When the United States military attacked Fallujah, we killed so many people that the municipal football stadium of Fallujah had to be turned into a graveyard for the dead, and the football stadium turf had to be ripped up, and it had to be filled in with the bodies of those killed, women, children, and the elderly, primarily the elderly, because the elderly are the least mobile and the least likely to be able to get out of the way of an American assault. So you didn't see that here in this country. This is one of the most depressing things, having just been to that football stadium, having seen that, having interviewed a 12-year-old boy who told me his 11-year-old best friend was gunned down in front of his school, to come back to this country and find people were so ignorant about that. I felt, well, I have to write a book, because I have to keep disseminating the information I've already reported. I can't move on to the next story, because this story has not adequately been understood yet. But in Iraq, everyone's glued to their TV watching this, and it was a important moment. You know, the book is How America Lost Iraq. This is the moment, I think, when America lost Iraq, because people were sitting at home, they were watching these images, they knew it was going on. Their relatives were telling them the same thing, and they were just, okay, enough is enough. Let's get these people out. I like to be on commercial radio, a lot of returned soldiers listening to commercial radio, talk radio. I like to be able to talk to them. They call in, and it's good for me, too, as somebody who is in Iraq and not embedded. Never talk to the American soldiers over there, because, of course, they have guns, they might shoot me. I mean, they shot four Iraqi journalists this summer, all when they were just driving their cars. This is not an idle joke. It's, I mean, they're nervous people. They shoot people because they're so concerned that they might be suicide bombers, and they kill journalists and regular people all the time. In Iraq, they shot this TV director. He's on his way to a wedding. He misunderstood what they said at the checkpoint. They blasted his car with 15 bullets. Another reporter, Stringer for Knight Ridder newspapers, which owns a lot of papers, the Detroit Free Press, San Jose Mercury News, was driving around his own West Bank neighborhood, shot in the back of the head by a U.S. military sniper. I didn't want that to happen to me, so I was as far away from the Americans as possible in Iraq. But here, I'm very interested, you know, in getting their side of the story. And in a lot of ways, being on commercial radio enables that. But at the same time, being able to dialogue with people one-on-one who are involved in the activist movements is also important, so they can be better informed in, you know, what they advocate for.
So what was daily life like for you when you were in Iraq?
We were living in, myself and two other journalists, we were living in a building called the Beit al-Dulaymi. It's owned by the Dulaymi family, which is a very big, important family in Fallujah. So I always thought, well, these people are the resistance, so it's probably a pretty safe place to live. They're not going to blow up their own building. In the early days, you know, there's no electricity. This is annoying, especially when it's 125 degrees and you don't have a fan. You can get grouchy. mean, Baghdad is a city. It's 6 million people. It's spread out, a lot like L.A. It's hot. Distances are far. Imagine L.A. where people don't have air conditioning and there's not a single reliably working traffic light. I mean, people get mad. They start shooting at each other. And that's what happened in Iraq. So, means that you spend a lot of time stuck in traffic in Iraq if you're a reporter, because you have to go to lots of different locations. And some days I would just be like, oh my God, I am not going out in that traffic. I'm just going to stay home and make phone calls. You know, and I made a major effort to talk to different sections of society, to go to different neighborhoods that are richer and poorer, to go to fundamentalist political movements and secular political movements, to spend time in northern Iraq. I was in northern Iraq, different parts of northern Iraq, in Baghdad, in Fallujah, in Najaf, in Babylon, in Kut, Diyala, lots of different places. And, you know, the main way I would do this is I would find somebody that I knew who was from a particular place, and I would say, let's go. So I went to Diyala. Diyala's in the heart of the Sunni Triangle. I went there right in the middle of the attack on Fallujah, so Diyala was on fire. But I went to the uncle of a friend of mine's house. He happened to be a general in the old Iraqi army, and he was negotiating trying to negotiate a ceasefire with the Americans. And I went with his nephew, and so, you know, I showed up, and they said, oh, you know, my nephew so-and-so, and who was your friend? Respect. Respect is a basic issue in life. And, you know, it's amazing how much these kindergarten rules kind of play out in the real world. They understand that they want their story told. So, but the problem is, well, let me just say, in the fight against Mukhti de Sadr, one day I was like, okay, I have to go to Sadr office and interview people in the Sadr office. So I show up at the Sadr office in an old beat-up purple van with somebody who's related distantly to Mukhti de Sadr, and I interview the folks in the office about what they think about the fact that an American Apache helicopter has bombed their office the night before. I get their opinions, and then I go and I interview other people. The same day, a reporter from a major U.S. newspaper went to a different Sadr office, showed up with a whole bunch of armed men to protect him, and they said, I'm so-and-so with this major newspaper. They said, no, you're not. What kind of journalist comes with all these guns? And he said, yes, I am. And they kidnapped him. And they said, we'll let you go once we figure out that you're a journalist. And they did, eventually, a few hours later. And he was worried that he might be there. So, I mean, he shows up in this GMC Suburban. It's really funny, actually, in Iraq. You want to know, how is it that the resistance knows who are the contractors, right? Mm-hmm. It's very easy. They're all driving white GMC Suburbans. Right. I mean, outside of the Palestine Hotel in central Baghdad, you have a parking lot. It's just full of white GMC Suburbans. And wherever you see them, that's the occupation. Right. That's the target. Uh-huh. And a lot of these mainstream journalists are also traveling in, you know, bulletproof SUVs. And I don't know why they don't understand that it's much safer to be in a regular car than it is to be in a bulletproof SUV that somebody's going to try to blow up because they affiliate you with an unpopular foreign military presence. And so then the American journalists, other foreign journalists, are sitting in their hotel. I mean, there's a point at which I wouldn't watch CNN in Iraq because it was just completely useless from my perspective. So I watched Jazeera and Arabia and sometimes the BBC. And there was a certain point. I mean, you live in Iraq, you know what it looks like when they're doing the stand-up from the Palestine Hotel and they don't go anywhere else. You're like, that's Ferdo Square, that's the view from this side of the Palestine Hotel, that's the view from that side of the Palestine Hotel. This woman did not leave the Palestine Hotel. And there's a certain point when the situation started to get unsafe. The BBC, at least, they never left the Palestine Hotel. Now, how are you supposed to explain what's going on in Iraq if all you do is take the U.S. military's word for it? You know, so they would say, we have new information, breaking news today. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, the spokesperson for the Coalition Provisional Authority, says blah, blah, blah. And I said, that cannot possibly be true. I was there. I mean, I was in Sadr City. I was in Fallujah. I saw what's happening. And that's a lie. I mean, I can say, and it was just infuriating. I started to yell at the television because it's one thing to be sitting here in America and have a vague sense that what you're getting is not completely the truth. It's another thing to see what the U.S. military is actually doing with your own eyes, come back to your apartment, turn on the TV, and have somebody who's broadcasting to the entire world say something completely different.
Once again, we hear the word precision from people who think bombs can be precise. We hear the price of fighting terrorism from people who don't have to pay that price. We see a cloud where there should be a college. We see a reservoir reduced to soil. And though they now admit that the marketplace was hit, they didn't hit the Ministry of Oil. What they call a military target is sacred to all soldiers brave and loyal. You can bomb a shrine, you can bomb a power line, but you never bomb the Ministry of Oil. Once again, the mayhem they call warfare is followed by the melee they call peace. Tearing through the stores and the museum, while the U.S. Army played police. How much do you suppose that artwork sold for as their last remaining food began to spoil? The situation's bad, but no place in Baghdad is safer than the Ministry of Oil. The medicine has all been confiscated, and soon there won't be water left to boil. And one might wonder who'd think up names like oil for food, when what they mean is Ministry of Oil. If there's any logic in the universe, if the future isn't just absurd, if justice is precise instead of infinite, if freedom is enjoyed and not endured, I'll take my class out someday on a field trip, past the shells of Shell and Uniroyal. And as they're roaming round the musty White House grounds, I'll say, kids, this was the Ministry of Oil. I'll say, kids, it was a peaceful revolution. There weren't any battles to embroil. And I'm very glad to tell that not one person fell. It's an aspect of our history that ever child knows well how we failed to avoid one building being destroyed. But at least it was the Ministry of Oil.
That was Ministry of Oil by the Prince Mishkins. Next, we have Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week, we present Kevin Danaher, co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange, who looks at America's growing crisis of confidence in the direction of the country and what he sees as the role of the progressive peace and social justice movement. Steve Bradbury, a community organizer with New Orleans Acorn, who talks about his group's priorities in rebuilding the storm-ravaged city. And Village Voice columnist James Ridgway, who discusses his forthcoming book, The Unanswered Questions About 9/11. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In federal court in Bridgeport, Connecticut, District Court Judge Janet Hall ordered the FBI to lift a gag order on a Connecticut librarian who had received a demand for records from federal investigators. The gag order was issued to stop the librarian from engaging in the congressional debate over the reauthorization of the Patriot Act. The ruling was stayed until September the 20th, so the federal government could appeal the decision. The ACLU case was brought in August on behalf of an unnamed librarian or an employee of a nonprofit institution who received a so-called national security letter demanding all user information and records for its investigation. Prosecutors claimed revealing the identity of the person or institution served with the letter would tip off the suspects and compromise the FBI investigation into terrorism or espionage. In her ruling, Judge Hall rejected the prosecution argument. She wrote that the practical effect of the gag order was to silence constitutionally protected speech and prevent key voices from engaging in a national political debate. ACLU Executive Director Anthony Romero hailed the decision. In a statement, Romero declared, "Seizing library and internet records without judicial authorization offends most Americans, regardless of political ideology." In her ruling, Judge Hall said the FBI argument offered more speculation than hard evidence in asserting that the case would be harmed by the disclosure of the person served with the national security letter. The Guardian newspaper reports top American scientists are objecting to a far-reaching congressional probe into the work of climate researchers involved with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The investigation, led by Texas Congressman Joe Barton, head of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, was launched after the Wall Street Journal quoted an economist and a statistician who, having no experience in climate change, questioned the methods of three American climatologists, Michael Mann of the Earth Systems Science Center at Penn State University, Raymond Bradley at the Climate Systems Research Center at the University of Massachusetts, and Malcolm Hughes of the University of Arizona. Barton and Congressman Ed Whitfield, head of an investigation subcommittee, are asking for every article the three scientists have ever published and all baseline data. A letter signed by 18 top scientists at Harvard and Princeton accused the broad information request as political intimidation and risks compromising the independence of scientific opinion. Moderate Republican Congressman Sherwood Bollert, head of the House Science Committee, also objected to the inquiry, calling it truly chilling, breaching the line between science and politics. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has pledged to veto the first gay marriage bill to be approved by a state legislature. Schwarzenegger, whose popularity has fallen in a fierce battle with state unions, says the same-sex marriage bill conflicted with Proposition 22, passed in 2000, that defined marriage as a union between a man and a woman. The governor's spokeswoman, Margita Thompson, says it would take a court decision or another proposition to allow gay marriage. Already, same-sex couples in California enjoy most of the legal benefits of marriage if they register as domestic partners. In 2006, the California Supreme Court is expected to rule on the constitutionality of Proposition 22. Jeff Kors, head of Equality California, the lobbying force behind the gay marriage bill, accused Schwarzenegger of pandering to the extreme right wing. Polls show increasing support for gay marriage among Democrats and independents, but strong opposition from Republicans. With his low poll numbers, Democratic strategist Roy Baer told the Los Angeles Times the governor needs to find friends somewhere. The only people left supporting him right now are the most conservative people in the state. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
President Bush's lack of leadership after the devastation of Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf Coast appears to have been a tipping point for many Americans in their dissatisfaction with the direction of the nation. A Washington Post ABC News poll found that 54% disapprove of the way Mr. Bush is handling the recovery from the hurricane, and 57% disapprove of his overall performance as commander-in-chief. The poll found that among African Americans, 63% believe that the problems with hurricane relief are an indication of racial inequality in the country. The president's mother, Barbara Bush, shocked the nation with comments made at facilities in Houston's Astrodome, set up for evacuees who lost homes and loved ones to the storm. The former First Lady told a reporter that, quote, "Many of the people in the arena here, you know, were underprivileged anyway, so this is working very well for them," end quote. Despite the resignation of Federal Emergency Management Agency Director Michael Brown, there is a widely held perception that Mr. Bush will never admit to a mistake and holds no one in his administration accountable for their failures. With the growing perception that Mr. Bush is disconnected from the realities confronting average people here in the U.S. and increasing opposition to the war in Iraq, many Americans are searching for answers, or at least new leadership. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Kevin Danaher, co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange. He looks at America's crisis atmosphere and what he sees as the role of the progressive peace and social justice movement in this moment in history.
Well, you know, the Titanic is sinking, and it really doesn't need us to catalog the injustices so much anymore because they're so blatant. It's out there. Anybody who reads books knows that global warming is causing more hurricanes and the ocean levels to rise. Well, when those ocean levels rise, what happens to the $10 million mansions in West Palm Beach and Boca Raton that are right on the beach? They go underwater first. So that's causing people within the establishment, people who run oil companies and run General Electric, way up in the ruling class, they're admitting that we're in a crisis. So when it gets that bad, we in the movement need to start shifting some of our attention. Instead of it being 95%, ain't it awful, here are the problems, and 5%, here are the remedies, it should be more 50-50 or, you know, 40-60 or something like that. And I think if you look at the collapse of the Soviet Union, you'll see something very similar in what's going on now with the U.S. empire. The Soviet Union, one of the main reasons that Soviet communism collapsed was you had an elite that were putting out a line, an ideology saying, oh, we're all equal. You know, oh, we're all brothers and sisters. But they were shopping in special stores, living in mansions, riding in limousines with big security. So here you have people who are doing the exact same thing. They're saying, oh, we believe in democracy, when it's obvious they don't believe in democracy. They don't believe in equality. This country was founded on the principle that all people are created equal, and they are endowed with natural rights that cannot be given up and cannot be taken away. But here they are carrying out policies that not only take away people's rights, they take away people's lives. So Bush's approval rating is down as low as it can be. People are waking up. I mean, it's kind of shocking that there's still 30-some percent of the population that supports Bush. But what's happened is there's been an opportunity here created for us to go out to people and say, look, there is a better way. If we marry social justice with environmental sustainability, we can fix these things that are wrong, and we can run things a lot better than the guys who are currently in power.
There's a lot of people in this country, as you said, the 38% who think George W. Bush and his administration is doing a fantastic job, who are pretty far away from the idea that the American empire is unraveling. When you saw those images from New Orleans where people were being videotaped without water and their babies were dying from dehydration and other afflictions caused by the lack of government intervention, what came to your mind in terms of your feeling about where this country's going? It elicited a lot of strong views, I know, all over the country, but what were you thinking?
Well, it's very similar to the war in Iraq, where the question is, how bad does it have to get before the American people are going to rediscover their spines and go out in the street and say, these guys have to be fired? If you or I performed our jobs half as bad as the Bush administration is running this country and running the empire, we'd be out of a job. We'd be out on the street looking for work. So it's a question of accountability. But for there to be accountability, the citizens have to be informed. If you go to the Jefferson Memorial in Washington and you read the quotes of Jefferson that are chiseled in the marble, the highest quote that's up inside the rotunda, you have to bend back to look up and read it. He says, on the altar of God, I pledge undying hostility to any government restriction on the free minds of the people. The free minds of the people were supposed to be the bedrock of democracy. And that's the basic problem, is people are allowed, and in a lot of cases it's in their self-interest, to ignore what's going on. If you went out with blank maps of the world and held them up to Americans and said, point to Iraq for me, would you? What percentage of Americans could even find Iraq on a map? Yet we've massacred between 20,000 and 100,000 innocent Iraqi men, women, and children, and most Americans don't even realize it. That's not counting the hundreds of thousands of people that were killed by the sanctions, the economic sanctions that were imposed under the Clinton administration. So on the one hand, yes, that's awful, but it creates a situation for those of us who are educators and activists to go out and educate people and say, come on, moral authority says we got to do something about this. It's just like if you were walking past a house on fire and you saw a child screaming at an upstairs window, you wouldn't go to the library and read a book about combustion. You'd break down the door and go in and save that kid, or it would haunt you for the rest of your life that you were a coward and you didn't step up to the plate when moral authority said you had to act in that situation. If we don't rise to this historic challenge, what are our kids and our grandkids going to say about us and about how we failed in this important historic test?
That was Kevin Danaher, co-founder of the human rights group Global Exchange. Contact Global Exchange by calling 800-497-1994 or visit their website at www.globalexchange.org. Rescue and recovery work continues on the hurricane-ravaged Gulf coasts of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama, with still no reliable estimate of the number who died. But officials are now pulling back from early predictions that 10,000 or more perished in the storm. Thus far, Congress has allocated $60 billion in emergency funds to assist the hundreds of thousands who have been displaced by Hurricane Katrina. As New Orleans digs out from one of the worst natural disasters in American history, the city's residents are scattered from Baton Rouge to Texas and points much further away. While plans are being made for the historic city's restoration, the New Orleans and Louisiana chapters of ACORN are determined to play a role in the rebuilding of the Crescent City. ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, is the nation's largest community organization of low and moderate income families. Across the U.S., the group has more than 175,000 member families, including 9,000 families in Louisiana. Among its priorities, both before and after Hurricane Katrina, is the construction of affordable housing and the creation of living wage jobs. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Steve Bradbury, the New Orleans lead organizer with ACORN, now relocated to Baton Rouge. He talks about the immediate tasks at hand, as well as longer-term concerns.
We've been trying to get people together to begin to, you know, identify ways to address access to the city, access to jobs as they begin to open up to help rebuild New Orleans, and to make sure that as that process, you know, unfolds, that low and moderate income families are not left out of the loop, because there's a great fear that as they go to rebuild New Orleans, that things will be set up such that they will price it out of the range of many of the people who want to live there.
I just read that FEMA is sending in hundreds of workers to begin the cleanup process. Do you know if those are displaced New Orleanians who are desperately seeking jobs, or if they're coming from elsewhere?
I couldn't give you numbers, but we certainly would have liked to have seen a greater emphasis on trying to locate local workers for that process, as well as if there weren't enough people from New Orleans proper to try to then begin to employ people from around the state. One of our biggest concerns in that whole area is that this is an opportunity to begin not just to rebuild New Orleans, but to develop, you know, skills for people to, you know, because Baton Rouge will also have to begin to do some more building because their population is now doubled. In terms of the state as a whole, we certainly would have liked to have seen them try to reach out to more of the people who live here, who are more familiar with the area, the landscape and all of that. But we're also very concerned that living wage jobs are not going to be respected. You know, from my understanding, the president waived the Davis-Bacon rule, which would have forced the developers and people who are going to be working on rebuilding New Orleans to pay prevailing wages. Now they won't have to do that. So on top of the fact that people are homeless, unemployed, and dealing with all of the adversities that they have to deal with, in terms of them coming back to work on rebuilding their own homes, they won't even receive decent wages for that. And that's highly discouraging.
Maybe that directive could be reversed if enough pressure was brought.
Right, and that's one of the things we're working on at this time is putting pressure on local, state, and federal politicians. You know, that's one of ACORN's issues prior to the hurricane.
Besides jobs, is any other issue a priority right now for ACORN in New Orleans?
There's extreme concern regarding the housing situation. You know, New Orleans had a high percentage of renters, and if steps aren't taken to assure that they will be allowed to come back into the city, we're highly doubtful that these developers will be providing affordable property.
Do you think it's realistic to rebuild New Orleans in the same location, given that it's below sea level? And I've read that due to various factors, it's going to be sinking even further over time.
Part of the problem that we're dealing with now is because the federal government did not put up the monies in order to fortify the levees. Right. It wasn't that the levies were not high enough, right? It's just that they weren't fortified because the president vetoed the money. He had greater interest in his war effort as a form of national security as opposed to building up and making New Orleans a more secure city. Right. This was not something that was unforeseen. Right. It was known that if a hurricane ever came that way, what would be needed, and it had been suggested that these levees, you know, be fortified and built up. In fact, Congress had agreed to spend the money on it. And it's very important to note that that was something that the city and others had sent out. The Army Corps of Engineers had, in fact, brought that up as an issue. And that is a very important part of the whole thing. Specifically because when, I think it was Hurricane Betsy in the late 60s, you know, the levee was broken. And they flooded out the Lower Ninth Ward, which is the same neighborhood that got flooded out this time. And so for a lot of residents down there, there's quite a bit of talk about of conspiracy. So it's something that is definitely within the, you know, I guess you could say the folklore of the city. And so it is important to note that this was a problem that had been identified prior, but that was not dealt with. And as a result, we ended up with our entire neighborhoods being flooded out. Because if you recall, the majority of damage that we're dealing with now and the level of problems are not from the hurricane itself, but once those levees began to break open.
Does it seem like city or state leaders have any vision for recovery or any power to make anything happen, or is all the power in the hands of the feds?
Actually, from what we've seen, it's not apparent that anyone has a plan, whether it be federal, state, or local. Right? Everyone is in a very reactionary state. And as a result of that, we're having to deal with, for instance, Halliburton getting a no-bid contract, you know, down close to the Gulf before people were even finished being evacuated. So, no, we haven't seen any inclination of a plan whatsoever at any level.
That was Steve Bradbury of New Orleans ACORN. Call ACORN's national office at area code 202-547-2500 or visit their website at www.acorn.org. On the fourth anniversary of the September 11th attacks that targeted the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and brought down an airliner in Pennsylvania, the nation was grappling with the destruction wrought by Hurricane Katrina and the flawed government response to that disaster. Many Americans believed that the President and Congress used the intervening 4 years since 9/11 to strengthen the government's emergency response system to better react in the event of new terrorist attacks or natural disasters. That confidence has now been severely shaken. As Americans remembered the thousands killed on September 11, 2001, many wonder if the investigations undertaken by Congress and the independent 9/11 Commission exposed the government's intelligence failures so that corrective action could be implemented to thwart future terrorist plots. Village Voice Washington correspondent James Ridgway doesn't think so. His new book, The Five Unanswered Questions About 9/11, examines the events leading up to the attacks and the glaring holes he found in the official September 11th Commission report. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with James Ridgway about the shortcomings of the investigation and why no one in government has been held accountable.
It turns out that the Federal Aviation Agency had actually received something like 52 different flyers or advisements warning of an attack between, you know, like the beginning of 2001 and the summer of 2001. And some of these warnings had contained information about a potential using airplanes as suicide weapons. The thing that really sort of gets to you is, well, if we had all these warnings, if the FAA had all the 52 warnings, after all, it's quite a lot, if we had these different warnings, like, how come we didn't know anything about this? I mean, the FAA, according to a staff study of the commission, thought something was going to happen in the summer. Well, just put yourself in the position of a parent with a child. You're getting on an airplane. I mean, wouldn't you want to know at least that, you know, things that these guys thought things were dangerous? That's one issue. The other one is the 6 months prior to the attack, we had received, I mean, the United States intelligence community and I guess the United States government in general, had received warnings from various other intelligence agencies around the world, the British, the Germans, the Italians, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, and even Vladimir Putin sent a message warning us. Well, how come we didn't know any of this? I mean, you don't have to deal with this, you know, oohs and ahs about this presidential briefing document in August. I mean, this stuff was going on in the foreign press, and presumably to our intelligence people. It was going on throughout the 6 months. And we didn't hear a peep. Well, then there's the question of Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. Pakistan created the Taliban. They supported the Al-Qaeda. The students from their madrasas in the Northwest went and fought for the Al-Qaeda and for the Taliban. I mean, why isn't somebody from Pakistan, you know, asked to come before the commission and tell us what's going on over there? And the same thing with Saudi Arabia. I mean, Saudi Arabia, Prince Turki, the head of Saudi intelligence, was instrumental in being a go-between for us with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And I believe he was the one that actually found bin Laden and financed him. Well, now he's the ambassador to the United States. Like, isn't this kind of weird? So, I mean, there are questions like this that are just sort of like simple, obvious questions that I tried to ask, that's all.
Why do you think the commission itself didn't get to some of these hard facts? Why do you think the commission didn't really take the bull by the horns and examine these things in great detail?
Well, I think it's because, you know, everything in Washington is political. The commission was a political creation, you know. I mean, they did these deals with the president and vice president not to ask them independently what they'd done that day or take testimony from them, but to have them sort of like a little chit-chat with them, no notes. They didn't push Rumsfeld, and they certainly didn't bring up the subject of Pakistan, because Pakistan's our ally, and we don't want to mess around with them, because if we messed around with them, it's likely that something would happen between them and the Indians. So, and then the Saudis, of course, we depend on oil from the Saudis. They've been our allies for ages. And to get involved, you know, racking them over the coals would mean that we'd have to get into the big oil companies, and I don't think anybody had any real interest in that. So I just think it's a political commission. It's like the Iran-Contra Commission. You know, they just go so far and then they stop. On the other hand, they did have very good investigators, clearly. They had FBI people and so on. And they clearly did do a lot of serious investigation. So if you go to the footnotes on some of these pages, you'll see, you know, reference to these investigations. Well, you want to look at the footnote, forget it. It's classified. The thing is classified through and through. It's like classified for 7 years or whatever, and then the Justice Department can reclassify it, which they undoubtedly will do. So who knows? Who knows what they found out?
What do you think has to happen now in order to get at the truths that the 9/11 Commission did not get to give us the essential information we need to prevent another 9/11?
I mean, there are a variety of things that could happen. I mean, whether they're politically are possible, I don't know. I mean, number one, since the federal government can't seem to get it together to conduct a serious investigation, you know, there always could be the possibility that New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, Virginia, the states that were directly affected by this, could, as they have in civil areas, you know, come together and begin their own investigations, the attorney generals. I mean, a lot of these investigations into crime and big issues in the United States have proceeded from state attorney general investigations. It's like the tobacco industry, the insurance industry, the Wall Street stuff in New York City. I don't know whether any of these attorney generals would have it in them to want to do that. I mean, they might find it just too confusing, and it might be very difficult. The second thing that could happen is that you get some kind of a special prosecutor who would look into various aspects of this. I mean, if they can appoint a special prosecutor to look into Bill Clinton's sex life, they certainly could appoint a special prosecutor to look into the role, for example, of Cheney, who has no authority whatsoever to order shootdowns of planes on 9/11, or of Rumsfeld, who, you know, arguably dismissed intelligence that was given to him, showing that Al-Qaeda was behind this, in favor of pushing his ideas for Iraq. The other thing is a congressional investigation. There was one congressional investigation that was done under Bob Graham, the joint, you know, inquiry of the Senate and the House, which is really very good as far as it went. And the commission was supposed to follow that on and develop it, but they didn't do it. Congressional investigations, even if you're, you know, a liberal Democrat or something and don't like Republican because they're right-wingers, doesn't necessarily mean it won't work, you know. Those are several ideas, but the big thing that's got to happen here is people can't let this go. I mean, I don't think the families will let it go, but ordinary people just can't let this issue go. They've got to pursue it.
That was Village Voice Washington correspondent James Ridgway. His book, The Five Unanswered Questions About 9/11, will be published by Seven Stories Press in October. Read his columns online at www.villagevoice.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Meyerowitz, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome your participation, too. please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and hoping for your membership and your participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more, or just drop by the station. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by Paul Monnett. Go without hate, but not without rage. Heal the world.